As we wrap up 2025, one thing's clear. Uncertainty isn't temporary. It's the world we live in now. Noble Gold Investments helps Americans protect what they've built with real gold and silver, holding value when everything else feels uncertain. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and take your first step toward a safe future. This holiday season, when you open up a qualified account, you'll receive 10 one-ounce commemorative silver holiday coins. Visit Noble Gold today.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
I always feel the pressure to find the perfect gift for my relatives. In this case, whether you're sending an unforgettable gift or treating yourself to everyday perfection, Omaha Steaks delivers the world's best steak experience. For me, I'm not just into steaks. I like all types of meat. That's why I'll usually get the winter's bestseller pack. It comes with juicy fillets, chicken breast, pork chops, and even burgers. Omaha Steaks offers unrivaled quality and variety, and every bite is backed by their 100% guarantee. A family-owned company with over 100 years of experience in the meat industry. Save big on unforgettable gifts with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com for 50% off site-wide and earn an extra 20% off select favorites during their cyber sale. And for an extra $35 off, use promo code YUM at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code YUM at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. Go to omahasteaks.com to get 50% off site-wide plus an extra 20% off select favorites and more limited-time deals during their cyber sale. And use promo code YUM at checkout for an extra $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details. A big thanks to our advertiser, Omaha Steaks.
Hello everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Gaming in the Wild, a video games podcast about games from the artistic, creative side of the tracks, from indie to AAA. My name's John, I'm your host. This week in Reykjavik, what have I been doing? Let me think. I went out to an art exhibition yesterday. My friend was in a show a few miles from the centre of downtown Reykjavik. And I haven't been going out that much. We've had a little bit of a COVID spike, so I've been pretty insular these last weeks. But my friend had this show, and I wanted to go and show some support, so I got up on a bus and went up to Hafnarfjörður, the town next to Reykjavik, and had a really good time, actually. It was lovely to see some art. It was a great show about sentient beings, so it was all about nature and seeing nature as sentient. It's really, really enjoyable. But today is a Sunday, and on a Sunday I like to clean my house, I like to relax, I like to listen to some football and play some games. And I have been playing some games. I finished the second campaign of the card battler, deck battler I should say, Griftlands, which I've talked about several times on recent episodes and really enjoyed. I got to the end of the second campaign, where you play as a spy, and it's taken a while to kind of make friends with that game, but I have done so. I think I have 20 hours in it now, and I'm excited to talk about it with you today. But before I do that, I thought I would also mention a couple of other games that I've been playing. And the main other game that I've been playing this week has been on the Switch. It's been Ni No Kuni, another game that I've mentioned in previous podcasts. It's the charming JRPG made in collaboration with Studio Ghibli. So it has these beautiful cartoon visuals. And I've been progressing through it quite nicely. It's a really, really charming game. It really, really is. It's got great kind of cartoonish voice acting with this boy protagonist. It's kind of naive in some ways. It feels like kind of Disney-ish. Like it's all very, very, very wholesome. You have a little sidekick who's a fairy called Mr. Drippy, who has this incredibly broad Welsh accent, which I absolutely love. So I've been progressing through that. I've been through a few bosses and kind of gone from region to region and place to place. It's a really nice little quest that you're on to give people heart and hope and enthusiasm, which has been stolen by an evil sorcerer. So you meet people who've kind of lost their lust for life, and they've become sad and they've kind of gone into a trance. And what you have to do is find people that are kind of springing with enthusiasm, and you can borrow some from them using a magic spell and then put it into the hearts of the people who've lost their enthusiasm. So it's all about bringing people to life and giving them hope. And it's really enjoyable. It's really positive. It's really wholesome. I will say that it started to become apparent that, much like many JRPGs, there is an awful lot of battles in it. So you'll be exploring the landscape and progressing the quest. But every minute or so, you'll be sucked into a kind of a battle in a separate scene. And it's a mixture of action and turn-based, so you can move around in real time, but you can also choose phases. You can choose to have a defense phase or an attack phase. And it's a little bit clunky, like trying to navigate menus at the same time as your enemies are moving around in real time. And I've also noticed that as I'm kind of rocketing through the game, the enemies are kind of leveling up quite quickly around me, and I've got a feeling that there is some level gating going on here. When I say level gating, I mean you have to be at a certain level to stand a chance in a battle, which means that if you don't enjoy the battling and you kind of escape battles or dodge them, as I tend to do actually, I'm not that interested in the kind of repetitive process of battling using the same few tricks again and again and again. And you level up by battling. So I've been skipping battles and I found that the game is getting much harder, and the game seems to want me to go out and grind a little bit for levels to be able to keep up with the bosses and the baddies. So I'm kind of losing patience with it a little bit, even despite how charming it is, because I feel like at the boss that I'm at now, I need to level up a couple more levels, which means just running around waiting for battles, and battles are maybe the least fun part of the game. So I'm 8 hours in. I took a look at how long to beat, and it's a 40-hour game. So I'm approaching a quarter of the way through the story, and I'm kind of feeling this way now. So if the next 30 hours plus of the story are going to involve loads and loads and loads of battles in order to progress the story, I'm not sure. I'm not kind of out on this game yet. I still really like it, but I'm kind of feeling like it might be the kind of game that I'll fall off and come back to later, or fall off entirely. But that's Ni No Kuni. That's the game that I've been playing on my Switch. I've been playing it like in bed on the sofa and relaxing with Ni No Kuni, with kind of a podcast or with something on the TV. But Fantasian had this great innovation, perhaps built to kind of sidestep the problem I'm talking about, where it had a device called the Dimension, where you can save up your battles. So as you're running around, maybe you can save up 5 battles, which means you skip them, but all of the monsters go into a kind of a storage tank, and then when you're at capacity, you have to fight them all at once. So you do one large battle, but there is more time in between them. And I think that Fantasian's innovation of the Dimension is a really good addition to the genre, actually. I kind of wish that I could skip through these Ni No Kuni battles or store them away and do them all at once, so they don't feel like they're interrupting my gameplay as much. But I don't know, I'll keep playing it, I'll report back, and I'll tell you how I'm getting on with that one. And before I move on to talking about Griftlands, I will briefly mention that this show is Patreon supported. If you would like to support this show, whether you're a long-time listener or a first-time listener today, in which case, welcome, then you can go to patreon.com/gamingin the wild, and you'll get some rewards for that. You'll get some sale recommendations, an invite to our Discord community, and occasional extra episodes. So thank you very much to all of my existing patrons. I really appreciate your support. And thank you very much if you're considering taking part and becoming a patron. I will also say that something that can be done to show your support for the podcast in other ways would be sharing the podcast. Share it with someone that you know, or post it out on your social media, or if you're on an Apple device, giving a 5-star rating, maybe even dropping a few words. These are all great ways to help me out with the podcast and show your support for the podcast. Reviews help people to find it, basically, so they help more people to find the show. And with all of that said, let's move on and talk about the featured game of the episode, Griftlands. So So Grifflands is a game that came out this year. It's by Clay Entertainment, who made, I believe, Don't Starve is their claim to fame, but they've done quite a lot actually. And this game came out across all platforms. It's on Mac and PC. I played it on a MacBook. I couldn't play it on my older MacBook. It wouldn't quite run it, 2016 Intel, but it's running very nicely on a modern MacBook. It's also on Xbox, Switch, and PlayStation. Although, I have to say, I have enjoyed playing it with a mouse. It's always a bit of an open question about how well these games are optimized for consoles, especially when you're clicking and dragging a lot, you're dragging cards, and you're clicking on enemies. Slay the Spire did a good job of this using the touchscreen, and Grifflands does seem to think of that game as a big reference point. So I'm not quite sure how it plays on consoles, but I'm willing to bet that they've done a good job. The reviews are quite good across platforms. It currently stands at 84 on Metacritic from the critics themselves, which is a pretty solid score, and 75 from players. So players weren't quite as into it. Partially, I think, because of the initial difficulty, which I will get onto. How long to beat has this game at 9 hours for the main story and 22 hours for completionists. I'm currently at 20 hours, having played 2 of the 3 campaigns. So I'm not sure if that time is for the original campaign, because I think the second character campaign and the third were added later. Or if I'm just being slow. I could be being slow. I did have some trouble with this game. In my first couple of playthroughs, it does have some difficulty and balance issues, I would say. But I'm actually really into it at this point in the game. I'm really enjoying it. I'm looking forward to that third campaign. I think I'll save it for next weekend. So Clay Entertainment described the game on Steam like this. They say, Grifflands is a deck-battling roguelite in which you negotiate, fight, steal, or otherwise persuade others to get in your way. To get in your way? That's a strange turn of phrase. They also say, every decision is important, be it the jobs you take, the friends you make, or the cards you collect. I say, Grifflands is an enjoyably engrossing crossover between visual novel, RPG, and strategic deck battles. With systems upon systems upon systems, it can be opaque and overwhelming, but it is saved by the inclusion of a brilliant story mode. So I actually think this is a particularly interesting game in terms of the division there between the way that the developers have envisioned this game and the way that I enjoyed it. It does seem that this game is meant to be endlessly replayable in the Slay the Spire style, but because it is a role-playing game which has a story, as you're battling, you can unlock battle-only modes, like just the card game, the deck-building battling card game, where you're fighting enemies through conversation or through combat using two different decks. But these mechanics are woven into a narrative story campaign, in fact, 3 of them. So you're playing as a character, you're going through a story, there are multiple choices and different endings that you can get based on your choices. I would say 2 main endings in each of the campaigns. So I would say that each campaign is replayable once, just to see what happens when you take the other side. You usually have a choice between going on the side of like the authoritarian government or the rebel uprising with your character in order to get to your conclusion. So it doesn't have that same infinite replayability that Slay the Spire has, and it does seem that is the model that they were going for with this game. But I actually enjoyed this game mainly as a story game with card mechanics rather than a card game with story mechanics, if you know what I mean. So I don't feel that it's an endless roguelite, which is different every time. I feel that it's a story game where you just want to see the other outcomes, and then I can't say now if I will play on just to play the card game after I've completed the outcomes that I wanted in the 3 story campaigns or not. I will report back later and let you know if I do end up getting addicted to this game in the way that the developers have envisioned. So the game has 3 story campaigns. The first one that you take on, you play as Sal, It takes place in the land of Haveria, a kind of a Wild West sci-fi fantasy outback. It's a really interesting world. It's an absolutely fascinating world. They've done a really good job of making it feel deep and complex and peopled with a history and a story in that kind of Disco Elysium way, where you feel like the world that you're in was there before you showed up and wasn't just kind of made for you. Like, the second you step in the room, it feels like there are things going on all the time around you. There are people going from place to place. There are different strands of story happening. And in the first campaign, you play as Sal, who has been stuck in indentured servitude for years out on the derricks. And these are kind of oil rigs out at sea that harvest a strange resource from the ocean. And Sal has been sold into slavery, basically, and has come back to Haveria seeking revenge for the person who sent her there. And so it's a classic Wild West story, really. Someone comes back to their dusty homeland in search of revenge after someone who has become powerful in their absence. So you start as a grifter, and that is someone that just goes around Haveria kind of taking on little jobs, much of it illicit, loads of illicit activities, loads of smuggling, loads of kind of bounty hunting and that kind of thing. And Sal arrives back at the tavern, the kind of saloon, a dusty floored saloon of an old friend, takes a room and starts to plan her revenge. And I will say that I found Sal's story to be really engaging, actually. I really wanted to see the end, and after I'd seen the end, I really wanted to take the alternate story branch, where you take a couple of different choices and make different allegiances. So it was very, very interesting to me. The story was interesting, the world was interesting, much more so than the combat systems, which are very complicated and a big part of the game. But the story was really what hooked me with this game. The writing, the characters, the plot lines and the scenario, that was really what hooked me and kept me playing. And the way that this game is presented is that there is an overworld, which is a single screen map that you look down on, like a top-down map. It's hand illustrated, as all of the graphics seem to be in this game. And you can see lots of detail on the map. You can see houses, you can see steaming chimneys, towns, forests and plains. And there's a couple of icons that appear on the map at any given time. And you just click on them and your character makes their way there. You might have some encounters along the way. And then you get to your location, which is a scene. And when you step into a scene, that map disappears. You see an illustration of where you've arrived, be it a bar or someone's house or a town, a mine, a secluded clearing, wherever it is that you are. They're all really pretty, really nice palette, really nice illustrated style to them. And then characters appear on that scene. You can click on characters. And we flip into a kind of a visual novel style at that point. The two characters appear on the left and the right. You have a conversation. You choose the path that you want events to take. Sometimes that will result in a kind of a combative conversation where you use one of your decks, or it might deteriorate into combat. And the conversations and combat are, you might be familiar with them from previous deck battlers. Your hand appears at the bottom of the screen. You play cards, your opponent plays cards, and you basically have to defend yourself, take out offensive actions, be it harsh words in conversation or be it blows in combat, and then you have to just win the day and head on your way. So it's a really interesting mixture of styles. It has this RPG element where you're upgrading your character, you're upgrading your deck, you're making choices that actually do affect the overworld and the wider world of Haveria. You're engaging in these card-based battles. And then you have these visual novel style story sections where you're in conversation, asking questions, learning, reading about the different characters' backstories. And it works surprisingly well. These three different styles of game have been interwoven here really, really well. And exploring this kind of this dense, strange world of Haveria, it's a real pleasure. And there is a lot to learn about this world. Everyone that you meet belongs to one clan or another, if they're not a grifter like yourself, like an outsider and a traveller just getting by. There is a bandit clan called the Spree, who are kind of, how would you say it? They're like indigenous locals who've been forced into this kind of clan lifestyle. there is an invasive colonial force called the Admiralty, who've come from elsewhere, and they've attempted to form a dictatorial government, and they're like the bad cops of this scenario. There is the Spark Barons, a group of rich, cruel, union-busting oligarchs who excavate ancient tech and turn it into weapons that they can use to control the populace. There is the Cult of Hesh, and they worship a Lovecraftian tentacle god who lives on the ocean floor and controls the tides. They're like the religious sect of the peace. And there is like a tribe of boggers, and these are heavily religious, superstitious people who live deep in a hostile swamp, and they steal away passers-by, kill them, and feed them to the swamp. So there is a whole load going on here. It reminds me a little of like a Dune. It has that sort of that feel of like a world with nobles and clans and power structures going on and politics and lots of different kind of fantastical things happening around you. And it also has this kind of dusty outback feeling. It does feel like a spaghetti western sometimes, the way that you drift from town to town. You meet people that you used to know. Everyone's got a story. Everyone's got a story to tell. There are lots and lots of characters that you can interact with on your way around this world. You will have lots of random encounters on your way around the map. And so the scenario is very rich, and it can feel a little much at the beginning, but that's offset by the inclusion of a hypertext system, a little bit like that scene in Pyre by Supergiant, in which words that are particularly important, for example, Hesh, the god, or Spark Barons, or Spree, or the name of a character that you're talking to, you can hover over that word in the text, and a little tooltip will appear that is just a short reminder of what that means. And that actually served a really good purpose in this game, much like it did in Pyre. I would say that Pyre is another reference point for this game. Pyre itself, the Supergiant game, is such a mash together a visual novel, an exploration game, and a sports game in that particular title. And it has this dense world that you have to learn so much about to get your bearings. And Grifflands borrows that system from Pyre, and it really does make a difference. It makes the world feel more understandable, more open. You have more ways into it. And the first time that something is mentioned, you don't have to retain that information straight away because there is a lot going on. And it would be a little much. I would have felt very lost in the lore of this Havarian world were it not for those tooltips. So they've really done a good job of explaining this amazing world they've created. I think fans of sci-fi, fans of fantasy novels will find a lot to like here. It's very dense, it's very interesting, it's very layered, it's very well thought out, and it feels alive. And a large part of the reason that it feels alive is that I've played through it a couple of times, and this is where the roguelike element of it comes in. I've encountered a character, I think there was a guy called Ran or something like that was his name. And the first time I encountered him, he was like a background character in a story, and I didn't think much about him. The second time I passed him in a random map event, he was going somewhere, and he was being chased by people that were trying to rob him. And I saved him. I saved him from being robbed. And so he became a friend of mine and gave me gifts later in the game. Another time I found myself against him in combat because I'd chosen the other side in that particular playthrough. And I found myself warring against him and actually taking him out. And that goes for most of the characters in the game. Most of the times when you arrive at a bar or when you arrive at a building or a base of one of the factions, there'll be three or four characters on the screen. You can talk to all of them. There's one that is the main quest giver or the main point of focus, but you can talk to the people in the background. You can try and buy them a drink to become friends with them. You can kind of curry favor with them in some way. And so you get people that love you, people that like you, people that dislike you, and people that hate you. There's like a 5-point scale, and neutral is in the middle. And based on how much they like or don't like you, if you encounter them at different points in the story, they'll respond to you differently. They might choose to help you or give you a hint. They might gift you an item that's going to help you out or give you a card, even better, for your deck. If they don't like you, they might go against you in that kind of scenario. And if they hate you, you will literally get a debuff based on that when you come into combat. So the more people that hate you, the more debuffs you'll get in combat. The more people that love you, they'll give you powerful cards that you can use. And so currying favor in the game is kind of important. And I think that's part of what brings this world to life in the way that it has been so successful in doing. Because all of the characters around you have their own thing going on. You feel like they're all moving across the map, doing different things. And there are so many random encounters. I've never had the same one twice. And so these characters can be friends, they can be enemies, and that gives it a really lively feeling, like the world really, really is ticking over around you as you move through the game, and that's quite a powerful atmosphere to create. And there are also quite a lot of systems in this game. There is a lot to learn. It's a complicated game, and I'm going to run through some of them here. First of all, there are the decks. There are two decks. Your conversation deck, which is built around influence, domination, arguments that you can make to try and win a battle. You have something called resolve, which is like your defense, and then you can choose whether you want to be dominant or whether you want to be influential. So you're either persuading or you are arguing and trying to impress your viewpoint upon the other. Then there is the combat deck, where it's basically defense and attack. But within each of these decks, there is a huge amount of complicated synergy that can be created. For example, if you are running a deck based on influence, then you want more cards that are green in the color scheme of influence, such as persuasion or bluffing or things like that, whereas if you're dominating the conversation and arguing and you're kind of a more combative conversationalist, then there are things like shouting or things like that. So you can kind of build your deck based on which direction you've chosen to go in. And there are lots and lots and lots of systems in this game. I still don't understand half of the intricacies of what these cards do. After 20 hours, I still really don't get a lot of what's going on with these decks. Which is part of the main criticism I have of this game, which will come a little later. But in terms of the currencies, there are also grafts. These are buffs that are melded onto your brain. It's like a computer chip that gets put into your head, and that gives you a buff for the rest of the game. For example, making some cards more powerful or giving you more hit points, things like that, or some special abilities that are situational. There are shills, which is the currency of the game that can be used to buy cards, buy grafts, things like that, to pay bribes. And you get shills for doing tasks, for grifting, basically, for playing the game and doing missions. And for killing people, if you choose to do so, you'll get shills, you'll get to pick their pocket. There are pets in this game. You can choose to buy or sometimes just acquire through the story a robot dog or an animal that will fight alongside you. And then you can build that up. You can build up that pet. You can train it sometimes. You can get armor for it, that sort of thing. There are also companions. These can be hired mercenaries that you pick up because you've got a lot of shills in your wallet and you know you're about to do a hard mission. Or sometimes you'll get story companions. There are escort missions, for example, taking a fugitive from A to B or capturing someone out in the wild and bringing them into the law, whatever you want to do. Sometimes in those stories, you'll also get options of whether you want to fulfill the quest or let them go. And then you'll also get story characters, like allegiances that you make. Some of the missions will involve taking along a main story character with you. And I encountered once a beggar who asked me for some shills. I had lots, so I gave some to him. And he ended up accompanying me for most of that run as an extra character in battle and was actually really, really useful. So you get companions. And then, of course, you have the cards. At the end of each battle, you get the opportunity to pick a new card, whether it's for negotiation or whether it's for combat. And picking your deck and trying to get a synergistic deck in which the cards are kind of positively complementing each other is a big part of the game. My most successful combat deck was with the second character, Rook, who has like a flamethrower. And so you can burn characters, which means that they're on fire, they lose a little bit of health each combat. And then there's another effect called Scorch. And if your character is burning and you play an attack that has Scorch, then Scorch will deal extra damage. And there are lots and lots and lots of systems like this stacked on each other. Too many, I would say, from my playthrough. I've struggled to orientate myself within how my cards are affecting each other. I have kind of gotten through a large part of the game just by treating it as defend and attack and having a very rough understanding that if I'm in an influential mode, then I should play green cards, and if I'm not, I should play red cards. And so I've gone through it with kind of a simplistic take on all of this stuff, and I feel that the intended complexity is a little lost, partially because it's never really fully explained. I think that this game assumes a certain amount of deck-building knowledge in the player that I really didn't have. And so I found myself feeling lost. I found myself losing battles without really knowing why. The conversation structure, for example, has arguments. So you have your central health, and then you have these arguments that appear around you based on the cards you've played, and your enemy does too. And you can attack an opposing argument and defend an argument of yours, and that argument of yours might be giving you a buff on certain types of cards. So it's just dizzyingly complicated and under-explained, and I would say that that's a big problem in Grifflands. I would say that that's why it doesn't quite succeed as a card game in the way that Slay the Spire does, because whilst Slay the Spire is complicated, the systems feel more, more coherent and clear. And I would say that the various systems of Grifflands felt to me to be somehow more opaque. Even with tooltips, I felt that the systems were difficult to get my head around throughout the game. And Grifflands has a couple of modes that you can play in. The first is the roguelike kind of campaign mode, where it has permadeath, and it's intentionally difficult, I would say. And the first couple of times that I played as Sal, I played this mode. I was progressing through the game nicely, I hadn't really lost any fights, and I was really enjoying the story. And then there is a second day boss that I've seen from other podcasts that have, the Short Game, for example, did an episode about Grifflands, and most of the hosts in the Short Game died at the second boss, just like I did. And that was a bit of a rude awakening to me. It's permadeath, your run is over, and you can't continue. That's it. Your role-playing experience is done, you've lost to a boss, you're dead. And that I found quite sort of shocking at the time. I was kind of taken aback that my progress had just been deleted. I tried one more run, armed with the knowledge that I had accrued about the way that decks work, maybe what kind of cards I'd like to go for, and died at that boss again. It just seemed impossibly difficult, and, you know, five times as hard as anything you'd encountered in the game. It seemed to require a detailed understanding of the decks that had not really been trained. And so I felt that it was a little unreasonable, to be honest. And so I flipped to story mode. And in this mode, you get more health, you get more resolve, not a lot more, maybe like 15% more, something like that. And you can replay starting on the day. So the game's divided into 5 days. Each day takes about half an hour or 45 minutes. And that means that if you die on day two, then you start from the beginning of that day, and you can replay that day. And so I played the rest of the game on story mode, and that means that you can be a little less careful in your battles. You don't have to be quite so obsessed with protecting your hit points. You can play in a little bit more of a carefree way. And when I went onto story mode, I got through to the final boss of the game on my next round, died again. And by that time, I think I'd really started to understand at least the basics of how decks work, how arguments work, how some synergies work, and kind of just how to play the game. And I would say that at that point in my trajectory with Grifflands, I was probably 12 hours in. So it was quite a commitment to get to that point of feeling like a basic understanding of what's up in this game. But on my next run, I did much better. I built a much more coherent deck, and I finally defeated Kaggio, the first kind of story villain, and that unlocked the story of Rook, the second character. And I've played through as Rook since then, and having kind of gotten to the end of Sal's journey, I'd felt very invested in Sal, and I was a little sceptical that a second character could really grab me in the same way. But it turned out that Rook is like a double-dealing old spy who's returned to Havaria with a lot of kind of dark history. He's a saboteur, he's an assassin, he's a player, he's a real grifter in a way that Sal really isn't. Sal's kind of a young mercenary and a bit of a hard-ass, but Rook is like a double-dealing, kind of mustachioed, old, dashing spy hero. And so from that first story being like a Western about revenge, Rook's campaign and his story is very different. It's about coming into the lands, the boglands, where the Spark Barons dig up their ancient technology. So you're engaging in a different part of the world, a different map, a different region of Havaria. And you have a very different story where you're kind of playing two sides off against each other. And I ended up loving Rook even more than Sal. I really enjoyed that game. It felt like it had gone from a Western revenge story to a kind of a classic kind of Bogart World War II spy yarn. So both of the stories are fantastic. And I played through Rook on story mode as well. And I think having kind of gotten to grips with the campaign, I kind of wish I'd given him a go on permadeath, actually. I completed it on my first run. And maybe when I come back to it, I'll play it on permadeath and I will try and explore the other branch of Rook's story if I'd chosen the other side. So that's Griftlands. I really, really, really enjoyed this game. Shane on the short game said that it was like if Supergiant made a deck battler. And that's huge praise. And I think it's earned praise. This is a game that is beautiful to look at, that has interesting systems going on, great world building, hand-drawn graphics, good music that adds to the atmosphere, and lots going on. It feels like a classy production. It goes on to my Games of the Year list. I have been talking about that on Twitter a little, that I felt that it's a little bit of a light year. And even though I feel that Griftlands fails on some levels, I think the intention of this game is perhaps to create a Slay the Spire-esque, endlessly replayable card game. But I think it fails at that. It's too complicated and it's underexplained. Whereas as a role-playing game and as a visual novel, I think it succeeds on every level. So if you play it as a visual novel with deck battling included, I had a great time with that side of this game. And I will play the third campaign. I think I'll play Rook's campaign again. So I will have played every campaign twice and probably have gotten 30 hours out of this game. And I'll be very, very happy with it. It's just a very interesting kind of a clash that the deck building isn't what makes the game great, despite that being a central component of Griftlands. But there we go. That's my review. That's Griftlands. So that's our episode. Hope you enjoyed hearing about Griftlands. I think this is a very accomplished game, actually. I had a bit of a sort of a strange kind of critical response to it, I guess, for liking it for reasons that perhaps weren't meant to be the focus. But I guess thinking about it, the fact that they included a story mode means that they at least gave a player like me like a way to play this game and a way to enjoy it. And I'm really glad that they did. I think that's a very thoughtful inclusion and perhaps worthy of praise in its own right. I really liked Griftlands. It's one of the games that I've looked forward to. It feels like a quality game. I've kind of put it behind my ear and I've been playing it on Sundays when I've got a whole day to myself. And I'm really looking forward to sitting down and playing kind of, you know, a 4-hour campaign of Griftlands, having a good run at it. It's not a game that I've kind of squeezed in here or there, like Ni No Kuni or other games that I'm playing. It felt like the main event. It felt like a main game. So this has been Gaming in the Wild. If you'd like to come and connect with me on social media, Gaming in the Wild is on Twitter, on Instagram, on YouTube, Twitch, and Facebook, whichever platform you prefer. Facebook isn't that active. Honestly, Twitter is the main place that I am. I'm there every day, tweeting out screenshots, talking about games, and just chit-chatting with other gamers. Instagram, I post some screenshots of the things that I'm playing and some other stuff. And I do stream on Twitch occasionally and post occasional YouTube videos, but Twitter's the main one. If you would like to support the podcast, you're welcome to do so by posting a 5-star review on iTunes or by joining in on Patreon, which is at patreon.com/gaminginthewild. Big thank you to all my patrons as always. I'll be back next week with another show. I'm not sure what it will be about yet, but I've got loads of interesting games on the slate. So take care of yourselves and each other. Thank you for listening, and bye-bye for now.